there about approval or anything to that effect. And we know that in the third quarter of 1999, there is another specific set of documents that talk about CARP having to put together the strategy and to obtain the approval of the executive committee and the board of this. And the district judge, Judge Robinson, did not specifically find that there was approval. What she specifically found was that there was nothing that said they disapproved that particular policy, and that's undeniably true based on the statement in the minutes. They didn't disapprove it, but they didn't specifically approve it, and there's no evidence they did, and the best evidence is that they didn't, because they had to revisit that issue down the road. It seems to me that at least two central facts in trying to figure out when it's reasonable to impose a duty under these circumstances are, one, the recognition throughout that Rambus was trying to make RDRAM the single market leader in this context, and that until that fell out, there would be no reason to go after these partners. And that's undisputed. And the fundamental point about that is that after the summer, you get to the fall of 1998, what happens? Intel invests $500 million in Micron to advance RDRAM. That's well after the events that Mr. Powers identifies. So in fall of 1998, all appearances are that Intel is supporting RDRAM. Micron, ironically, is supporting RDRAM. No reason in the world to anticipate litigation under those circumstances. And the second fact that Mr. Powers doesn't do business with is the fact that there were no patents issued until the summer of 1999. And the absence of patents seems to me an enormously large contingency. So, Judge Loon, when you ask the question, how do you give content to reasonable foreseeability, it seems to me there are two things that I would propose. One is adopt Judge White's analysis of reasonable probability as a gloss to put on that in order to protect and to avoid a trap for the unwary under these particular circumstances.
Isn't reasonable probability a different standard than reasonable foreseeability?
I don't think it is, or at least Judge White didn't view it. He said they would reduce down to essentially the same thing. But the one thing it seems to me quite clear is that it cannot be just that there's a plausible claim that can be divined on that particular record. That's way too small a hurdle, and that is precisely the language that Judge Robinson had done. So she's way too far down. I think the ABA standard is the one you ought to adopt. But even if you thought maybe you shouldn't adopt it in across all issues, it does seem to me in this particular context, it is, where you're talking about pre-litigation and you're imposing the duty after the fact. That's the situation, it seems to me, where you ought to give the benefit of the doubt to the alleged spoliator in circumstances where, again, and Mr. Powers makes no mention of this, they did adopt a hold. They did try to preserve documents at that point in time when, in their judgment, litigation was more probable than not. So when you're going to deviate from that, it seems to me it's important to deal with it. The last point I'd like to make, and it goes to prejudice, because I think prejudice is still an important part of this, is you can't just simply analyze prejudice without regard to whenever the duty to preserve and the assessment of bad faith arises. And if the duty to preserve doesn't arise until sometime, even under Judge Robinson's analysis, after the first shred date, then you have tons of paper that has been shredded. Indeed, all of the JEDEC stuff would have been shredded. And yet, so there's got to be some better analysis of what would have been legitimately shredded and what would not. It cannot be that you just simply say under those circumstances, throw up your hand and deem that there's been some kind of bad faith. Particularly when the district judge's analysis in this context is there are all of these documents in these various categories. Therefore, it must be that relevant documents were destroyed. It would seem to me the opposite inference is drawable from those circumstances, which is that a lot of documents were retained. And indeed, I would say that the litany of documents that Mr. Powers identified, the Tate document, the CFO, and the Crisps documents belittling the document retention policy, if in fact there was an effort to destroy documents that was targeted to make yourself better off in this litigation, none of those documents would have been in the record. The very fact that those documents exist reveals that this was a content-neutral policy applied in that fashion and in a way that was not in violation of any duty to preserve, clearly not undertaken in bad faith, and certainly not in the way the judge analyzed it, and ultimately in no way prejudicial to their ability to try it. We should get an opportunity to prove both that these patents are valid and that they've been infringed.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Phillips and Mr. Powers. We will continue with the next case. Appreciate that. No, there's no need to change your tables. Just stay where you are. Unless you've already collected. The appellate can sit on this side, as that'll be easier, I gather. Are you adequately organized?